Hello, and welcome once again to Adventures in Theater History. In this episode, we will continue the story of Louisa Lane Drew, or, as she was known in her day, Mrs. John Drew. Once again, I'm very pleased that, as before, Philadelphia actress Susan Riley Stevens will provide the voice of Mrs. Drew for us. We left Mrs. Drew as she had just taken up the reins as the manager and the leading lady of the Arch Street Theater in Philadelphia. It was early in 1862, halfway through her first full season, and her husband, Mr. John Drew, the popular comedian, had just returned home from a world tour. Now, it's possible that the Drews' marriage was already rocky even before he had left, and certainly the 3-year absence did nothing for their relationship. And as we mentioned in the last episode, his co-star on that tour had been Louisa's half-sister, Georgiana, who brought home to Philadelphia a baby girl who had been born in Melbourne, Australia, and who was named after their other sister, Adine. Now, the story that husband John Drew and sister Georgiana had been writing in all of their letters home apparently was that while abroad, she had met and married an Australian actor named John Stevens. Mr. Stevens, the story went, had been unfortunately prevented from accompanying his young American wife on her subsequent tours due to his own pressing engagements. Yeah, that's the ticket. And then somehow never caught up with her again. But the obvious true explanation was right there for all to see, and it's unlikely that John and Georgiana's story stood up for very long after they came home. But apparently, Louisa, when presented with this new reality, simply took it in stride. Anyway, there was a theater to be managed, plays to be rehearsed, and employees to be paid every week. She herself was then appearing as Rosaline in Shakespeare's Love's Labour's Lost, along with the entire Arch Street stock company, including a new young actor named Mr. Craig, who was playing Lord Longueville. John's brother Frank was doing Custard, the clown, and as if that wasn't enough to manage, Love's Labour's Lost was followed on the bill by an elaborately produced Civil War melodrama called Scotto, or The Scout and the Spy, which featured scenes about the recent Battle of Bull Run and a grand tableau that showed the burning of Charleston. It was a busy week at work for Mrs. John Drew, actress, director, and theatre manager. The new little family member's name and parentage were simply and quietly entered in the family's Bible as Adine Stevens. The new mother and little Adine were given room in the family home, then at 138 North 8th Street, which still contained the three other Drew children, her son John Jr., and her daughters Louisa and Georgie, as well as Mrs. Drew's mother, Eliza Kinloch, now herself retired from the stage. And by all accounts we can find, it seems that Mrs. Drew was honestly happy to make a home for all the children in the family, whatever their provenance, and she was as efficient and thorough at home as she was at the theater. More room was made at the dinner table, and more space was made at the Drew family pew at St. Stephen's Episcopal Church on 10th Street. Above all, she knew that her reputation in the city of Philadelphia depended upon maintaining an appearance of respectability and propriety. So, no fuss. They were not a ragtag group of actors. After all, they were the first family of the Philadelphia Theater. Mr. John Drew, who had been wandering in so many ways, was quickly re-domesticated and put back on the stage, and no open acknowledgement was ever made of the embarrassment of the situation. Making the most of the local publicity about his return from his world tour, he threw himself into the family business, appearing at the Arch Street Theater for 100 nights, reviving his old roles in the repertoire with such staples as Shakespeare's Comedy of Errors and Sheridan's The Rivals, as well as bringing out all the highly popular stage Irishman characters in plays whose titles made their subject entirely evident. Sir Patrick O'Plenipo in The Irish Ambassador, Terry O'Rourke in The Irish Tutor, and Paddy Murphy in The Irish Dragon, the last of which was billed as a screaming farce. Mr. and Mrs. John Drew even appeared again together as Mr. and Mrs. Dove in the comedy called A Married Life. Newspapers hailed him the bright particular star of the arch, they said, and for the first time ever since Mrs. Drew had taken over management, the theatre actually began to turn a nice profit. However, perhaps all was not so contented in the actual Drew family home, for as the end of theatrical season approached, apparently John Drew quickly got the urge to travel abroad once again. In April, he announced he planned to be off to England, in whose theatres he evidently could always find work. The bill of the Arch Street Theatre for May 1st, 1862, advertised that he was performing the drag role of Old Mother Griffin in a play entitled The Groves of Blarney, and then as Ellie Croker in an afterpiece called The Miseries of Human Life, with the backing of the entire stock company, including his wife. Tomorrow, said the bill, he would appear as Rory O'More, but a note at the bottom of the bill gravely warned, "The public are respectfully informed that as Mr. John Drew's engagement will positively terminate on Friday, May 9th, there will be no repetition of any of his representations." Well, perhaps the Drews planned a divorce, or at least Louisa had made it clear to John she was not going to support him financially anymore. The Philadelphia Bulletin expressed sorrow at his imminent absence from the local stage. "When we think that this is the last time we shall see the gifted actor in these characters, we feel somewhat sad," it wrote. John Drew went off to New York for a few days to book his passage on a transatlantic steamer, then came home to Philadelphia to pack and to say goodbye to his children and their mothers at the narrow row house on 8th Street. On May 20th, 1862, he was carrying little Adine down the steep main flight of stairs in the house to join the 7th birthday party of his daughter Georgie when his foot slipped. Though he was successful in keeping the baby safe, he had no hand available to break his own fall, and to everyone's horror, John's head slammed against the newel post at the bottom of the railing. He died the next day from the subsequent brain injury at the age of 34. All those warnings in the playbills of John Drew's positively final appearance in the preceding weeks had tragically proven to be all too apt. Needless to say, everyone in the family was deeply distraught, including his young children. Mrs. Drew canceled all the performances at the Arch Street Theater, and the wake and his funeral were conducted from the family home. The Reverend Dr. Ducochet of St. Stephen's Church conducted the ceremony, and John Drew's brethren of the Phoenix Lodge of the Actors' Order of Friendship joined the cortege to Glenwood Cemetery at Ridge Avenue and 27th Street, where he was buried. The notice of his sudden and unexpected death was briefly and sadly noted in the Philadelphia newspapers, but in a time when the bloody carnage of the American Civil War was raging outside, there was hardly room for much more. Space was needed for all those long lists of local men, soldiers who were killed or among the missing or the wounded. Two of John Drew's younger brothers, in fact, who were then in uniform, on active duty, were unable to attend his funeral. But sadly, soon enough, they too would both meet their own deaths in service to the Union cause. On Friday, May 30th, 1862, the remaining acting company of the Arch Street Theater, including his older brother Frank and his first love, Georgiana Kinlock Stevens, appeared in a benefit performance for the Drew family. Mrs. Drew did not appear herself that night, but simply thereafter closed the theater for the season. In the odd way that the Drew family had, the specific circumstances of the death of John Drew were rarely referred to amongst them ever again. Even his son, John Drew Jr., who eventually would follow in his footsteps, barely mentions his father's passing in his memoirs, which would have happened when he was about 9. As for Mrs. Drew's autobiography, she too lightly passes by what must have been a very traumatic memory in her narration. But then, you know, at the very end of the book, just when you think she's done with her life story, she suddenly returns to the subject of her late husband, and of course tells us nothing about their relationship or what she felt about his wanderings or his death, but instead takes up the only possible suitable subject for public discussion, his talent on the stage. But even there, you can find a subtle note of rebuke, one that she had held on to for decades.
And now, let me devote a few lines to the late John Drew. He was one of the best actors I ever saw, in a long list of the most varied description. Had he lived to be 45, he would have been a great actor. But too early a success was his ruin. It left him nothing to do. Why should he study when he was assured on all sides, except my own, that he was as near perfection as was possible for man to be? So he finished his brief and brilliant career at 34 years of age, about the age when men generally study most steadily and aspire most ambitiously.
Though her departed husband's talents may not have been ever fully realized, she was determined to keep his name alive. Like a proper Victorian-era widow, forever afterwards, she was known to all the world as Mrs. John Drew. In another sad note, her sister, Georgiana, who might have earned that title back in the day had Louisa not intervened, passed away in 1864 from tuberculosis. Louisa took in her daughter, Aideen, and raised her, along with the rest of John Drew's children. But the show, to quote a much overworked truism, must go on. Louisa had a family to raise and a business to attend to. And as ever, she simply got on with it. Next September, Mrs. John Drew was mounting her next season at Mrs. John Drew's Arch Street Theater. That meant she was hiring actors, choosing plays, approving scenery, booking visiting stars, conducting rehearsals, supervising new renovations to the theater itself, as well as learning and practicing her own many roles as the leading lady of the company. Her lines, as always, letter perfect. There are very few direct accounts of how she went about her work, but we do know that everyone who worked with her or for her spoke of her with nothing but awed respect and admiration. Her schedule was relentless and regular. She would arrive at the theater in her small horse-drawn brougham at 5 minutes to 10, and rehearsals with the company would begin exactly at 10 o'clock and then continue for 4 hours. Since there were usually 2 plays on the bill to be prepared on any given day, a brisk pace was maintained in rehearsals, and Mrs. Drew expected her actors to be exact in their business and correct in their speech and their phrasing. In the afternoons, the actors were free. Mrs. Drew, for her part, would spend the time in the theater's office, going over the books and the daily receipts, sending off letters to New York and to London to secure rights and bookings for the latest popular plays and the available stars. She would return home to have dinner and tea with her children and her mother, and to issue orders to the domestic staff, kiss everyone goodnight, and then go off to the theater to either perform, or, if she was not in the play that evening, to carefully observe how everyone's performances went. On Saturdays, her children would come and see the matinees and mingle with the actors backstage. On Sundays, the whole family went to church. In her theatrical religion, she firmly did not believe in Sunday matinees. Her employees all called her the Duchess amongst themselves, and always knew to watch out for when she put on a certain red shawl and marched out of her office. It meant she was very displeased about some particular matter. But on the whole, the company was devoted to her and valued her instructions as to how they should act their parts, which were always based on her own long stage experience. The stage carpenters even allowed that she frequently taught them a thing or two, too. She was very sparing in her praise. If anyone did things well, a slight nod or an approving smile in the passages backstage was regarded as the highest accolade you would ever get from the Duchess. They also appreciated how she was extremely regular and conscientious with paychecks, which she never missed, and they ranged from $12 to $50 a week, The Arch was known as a good place for young actors, a real school where one could learn one's craft from top to bottom and get a wide variety of roles under one's belt. By the end of the second year as manager, she was able to pay off the mortgage on the theater, and the building stockholders were pleased as they watched their share prices rise. Generally, they knew that if she spent a great deal of money on any production, it would always provide a solid return. She staged a magnificent Christmas show that year called The Naiad Queen, a sort of Wagnerian spectacle in which she played Lurline, the title character, the leader of a trained corps of Rhine River Amazon warriors. In the final scene, the naiads all descended back into the river and swam away. The theater machinery required for this effect was billed as being made on an entirely new principle to which public attention is especially directed. And the mortals and the immortals mingled under the water, and the orchestra played away. Oh, there was even a special Christmas Day matinee intended for Philadelphia's younger theater-goers. Visiting star performers at the Arch usually received $500 a week in that era, which was a nice salary. Wallacks, Keens, Davenports, and Booths and other stars were taking advantage of the ease of railroad travel in that time to reach huge salaries as they went from town to town. The Booths, the offspring of Junius Brutus Booth, her former acting partner in the old days, were often resident in the city of Philadelphia. Edwin Booth had even bought the Walnut Street Theater, together with his brother-in-law, John Sleeper Clark, who lived in Philadelphia and was married to Booth's sister, Asia. Mrs. Drew knew them both well and performed with them in benefits in the city for the care of wounded soldiers from the front. In the spring of 1863, the youngest Booth brother, John Wilkes Booth, came to Philadelphia. Despite his heavy schedule, he, of course, found room for the great Mrs. Drew and played 2 full weeks of various classical roles and popular melodramas with her. His audience appeal was so large, in fact, that patrons were allowed to book seats 6 days in advance, a very unusual practice at the time. I can hardly imagine it, but even though she was, by that point, 43 years old, the 24-year-old John Wilkes Booth played Petruchio to her Catherine, Shylock to her Portia, and he also did a turn as Richard III to her, Queen Elizabeth, and the villain, Duke Pescara, in the play called The Apostate. When John Wilkes Booth had first appeared at the Arch Street Theater in 1857, he was a lowly member of the stock company of that day, and he was not regarded as a very good actor when he was a youngster, and often forgot his lines. But now, in March of 1863, John Wilkes Booth was a certified star, highly in demand. But during rehearsals, Mrs. Drew just pretended to defer to J.W. Booth's blocking, since he was the star, after all, but he likely knew better than to cross her. He was scared to death of her, in fact, says one historian. It was a highly successful engagement in terms of box office. The audience was very enthusiastic, the ladies joining in the applause, the Philadelphia Inquirer reported of one show. Later on, many years after his disgraced brother had played his dreadful role in history as a presidential assassin, Edwin Booth would also perform at the Arch Street Theater for Mrs. John Drew and give acting tips to her son, John Jr. In her usual way of editing out any unflattering facts, Louisa, for her part, did not mention her time on the stage with John Wilkes Booth in her eventually published memoirs. But his brother Edwin, she happily recalled, had a very sweet character and a very charming manner at rehearsals, which he detested. Though generally suspicious of the new, more naturalistic school of acting that Edwin Booth represented, she allowed that his famous portrayal of Hamlet was very fine indeed. Throughout the war years, and all the way to the end of the decade of the 1860s, in fact, Mrs. John Drew's Arch Street Theater remained a byword for quality and rigorous standards. "I would have played there for $10 a week on account of the prestige it gave an actor," said Stuart Robeson, one of the stock company's principal comedians. Mrs. Drew frequently traveled to New York in search of new plays and new actors, and box office managers and restaurant maitre d's there always had a seat or a table for her, like she was visiting royalty. President Lincoln, before his untimely and violent death at another theater, wrote and expressed a desire to see the Art Street Company and her in action. In 1868, the great novelist Charles Dickens came through town on a reading tour of America and was quietly ushered into a box at the Arch to see a performance of his friend Tom Robertson's play entitled Hours. All was going swimmingly well. For about 8 years, fortune favored me, Mrs. Drew recalled. Many of her acting company loyally stuck with her, but by the end of the decade, others eventually moved on. Quote, "During this time, many of my company went to New York," she wrote, "including Robert Craig, who was one of the most talented young men I ever met." Ah, yes, Mr. Craig, a handsome young comedian of the company, 20 years her junior, had in fact accompanied Mrs. Drew to the public reading given by Dickens in a very companionable way, and while he was there he studied that famous writer enough to do a burlesque imitation of him in the Art Street Theater's comic afterpiece the next week. I should also mention at this point that there was yet another addition to the Drew family household right around this time. In her mother, Mrs. Kinloch's family Bible, its pages carefully annotated with all the births, marriages, and deaths preserved for posterity, now in the collection of the Free Library of Philadelphia, there is an entry under the page labeled Miscellaneous. It reads, New York, August 28th, 1863. Sidney, only son of Sidney and Maria White, son by adoption of Louisa Drew. Now, why would she suddenly want to adopt a baby in the midst of all her other cares and duties? Well, not to put too fine a point on it, but numerous historians have concluded that her fourth son, Sidney, was not adopted at all, but was, in fact, the product of an affair Louisa had with Robert Craig, and that she had quietly slipped away to give birth to the baby boy in the summer of 1863. Is that correct? Confusingly, there are several different dates in various memoirs of when and how exactly Sidney joined the family. Before there were official birth certificates, you know, you could get away with stories like that if you needed to. For his part, Robert Craig certainly left her theater and her life sometimes after 1870. But exactly why and under what circumstances is not clear. Indeed, their relationship may not have been an impetuous affair, as it has often been portrayed, but it might have just naturally ended after having lasted for as long as 7 years. It's hard to tell, because there's quite a lot of suspicious fudging of dates and stories and Drew family documents when you start to really examine them. Much, much later, two of her grandchildren, Lionel and Ethel Barrymore, were quite clear on one matter in their own memoirs. However, Sidney Drew, whom they had always known by the affectionate name of Uncle Guggen, was definitely Mrs. Drew's natural son. And as he grew older, he certainly looked a lot like her, sharing her strong nose and her prominent eyes. Now, whether he looked like Robert Craig at all, I can't say. I'm still searching around for a photograph of him. But I must stress that I am not judging Mrs. Drew for her affair with a much younger man, if that's what happened, so soon after becoming a widow. It's fine with me if she chose to be a bit coy about whether she had 3 or 4 natural children, just as she may have been a bit coy about whether she had 3 or 4 marriages or any other unofficial romantic relationships over the course of her life. I mean, nowadays, the HR department might want to have a word with Louisa about having a romance with a younger subordinate, sure, but back then, the way she saw it, she had a position in society to keep up. Her business depended upon it, so therefore, Sidney was her adopted son. And that was it. All I'm saying is that Victorian lives were just as complicated as modern ones, if you look close enough. Don't let all those heavy leather-bound biographies in the library and those stern faces in all the old photos fool you. They had their fun and their personal messes, too. Where do you think they got the inspiration for all those intricately plotted melodramas, anyway? if she did have a late and middle-aged baby in the summer of 1863, Mrs. Drew deserves even more respect, I think, because that was the very time that the Arch Street Theater was undergoing a major reconstruction. This alone would have taken up all the attention of a mere mortal, but Louisa was a person of very formidable abilities and could obviously multitask, as we've already noted. But if she was otherwise occupied that summer, perhaps the theater's business agent and treasurer, Joseph D. Murphy, looked after the construction for her. Most of the renovations were to the front of the building. William Strickland's 1828 triangular pediment was removed, and a rectangular classical facade with two rows of windows looking out on Arch Street were added. The old statue of Apollo that had always graced the building was reinstalled on the upper level, and a bearded face of another theater god, perhaps Dionysus, was added to the cornice. New offices and workrooms with plenty of natural light were thus created, and more light was brought into the upstairs lobbies. Inside, the infamous third tier of balconies, where once prostitutes had roamed on a regular basis, was now totally eliminated. As we mentioned, this had been a long-standing goal of Mrs. Drew, who wanted to give the theater a much more respectable reputation. The second balcony level was instead enlarged, with sloped amphitheater seating all the way to the back, although it's true that the narrow supporting iron pillars, typical of Victorian-era theaters, continued to impede some of the audience's views of the stage. The total number of seats was not really increased, but the prices that could be charged were increased. In September 1863, Joseph Murphy had business cards made up which boasted of the new box office potential of the theater's expansion. Capacity of the house, $1,000, they read. The increased commercial capacity of the house really paid off, and the next 5 years were the high point of Mrs. Drew's management, both artistically and financially. With a repertory consisting of a few classics, sprinkled into a season mostly of popular comedies and fantastic melodramas. In November of 1867, for instance, the Arch Street Theater presented a comedy by Olive Logan entitled Surf, with an exclamation point, Surf. This was a production, a play with spectacular scenic elements, ones that were much more elaborate than the usual standard flats. The entire stock company of the theater was utilized, including Louisa Lane Drew herself, who played the grande dame role called Mrs. Madison Noble. The company's leading lady, Lizzie Price, played Mrs. Alice Warren, a soldier's widow, and Mrs. Drew's close personal friend, Robert Craig, played Mr. Simon Schweinfleisch, a rich German pork packer of St. Louis. Even General Ulysses S. Grant was put as a character into the play, and was portrayed by the company's leading man, William Osborne. The play, Surf, was meant to appeal to Philadelphians who were just beginning to take annual summer vacations at the Jersey Shore in those days. So, to flatter local sentiments, the theater pulled out all the stops, depicting such scenic vistas as the incoming tide, sea bathing at Cape May, a panoramic view of the Delaware, and the Columbia House, fashionable hotel in those days, down ashore. Surf evidently made an impression on Louisa Lane Drew's son John Drew, a youth at the time it was staged, and he later could recall the production vividly. Quote, "Oh, breakers were made by white cotton cloths and barrels. Now just how it was arranged I do not know, but in spite of the fact that the play was rather indifferent, it had a run of 8 weeks, which was at that time considered a very long run indeed." Augustine Daly, the well-known New York director and producer, frequently came down to see Mrs. Drew's shows, since he regarded her taste for material and actors as impeccable. He bought the rights for Surf as soon as he saw it, and he produced it in New York with some success himself. In fact, on his visits, Daly also took note of two intriguing new members of the Arch Street's company, Mrs. Drew's youngest children, Georgiana and John Drew Jr., then just entering their late teens. All the Drew children had been hanging around the theater their whole lives, as I mentioned, of course, and like many kids of theater people, they weren't really impressed with it at first. However, their mother was aware of her family's long history on the stage and was not averse to the addition of a new Drew or two to the evening's bill. The older daughter, Louisa, had some small success, but it was the younger daughter, Georgie, her mother's favorite, with her large eyes, her striking beauty, and her merry wit, that was an immediate success as an addition to the company. And on March 22, 1873, Georgie's older brother John, in his 19th year, made his stage debut in the comic sketch Cool as a Cucumber, playing the role of Mr. Plumper. He had previously been employed as a clerk, selling clocks at Wanamaker's department store, but he'd evidently grown tired of the dull possibilities of commercial employment, thought he'd give the acting biz a go. To get this first gig, however, he did have to meet his mother's high standards, and he carefully honed his elocution to rid himself of the distinctive Philadelphia accent he had picked up during his days at a local boarding school. To encourage him, his mother shared the stage with him in the skit and played the role of the maid Wiggins, who opens the door. Seeing the tall fellow with the fashionably long mustache on the doorstep, Wiggins knowingly turned to the audience and deadpanned, "Ooh, what a dreadful young man! I wonder what he will be like when he grows up." Well, what John Drew Jr. would be when he grew up was a Broadway actor, one of the great matinee idols of his day, in fact. Oh, Augustine Daly saw his potential right away and quickly snapped John up for his own company, along with another young leading lady, not Georgina Drew, but Ada Rahan, who became a big New York star. Now, it seems that John Drew Jr.'s mother was glad to see him succeed in the bigger market of New York because it was clear to her that Philadelphia was a limited market and permanently in the shade of its larger cousin, and that the Art Street Theater would have to cease its long reliance on the age-old stock company system at some point. Indeed, the Arch was one of the last theaters in the country to keep the stock company. With the ever-increasing capacity of rail transport, as we mentioned, big stars were now not just traveling alone to theaters around the country one by one, but were insisting on bringing along their own supporting companies with them, and even their own scenery. Mrs. Drew realized she had to bow to the winds of change and turn the Art Street Theater into what was then called a combination house, with some local actors in smaller roles, but the juicy ones going to the New Yorkers arriving from out of town. In February of 1874, for example, the melodrama Mom Cray was presented at the Art Street Theater for a week-long run. The play was advertised as, quote, strong in situation, absorbing in human interest, and opening a glorious impersonation of the Irishman as he is, close quotes. The production featured a thrilling and violent mutiny scene aboard a ship full of Irish immigrants on their way to America, a picture of which was graphically detailed on all the publicity posters. Maum Cray, M-A-U-M-C-R-E, evidently the name of a small Hibernian hamlet, the home village of the hero, was one of those combination productions, as we mentioned. The New York players belonged to the comedian Joseph Murphy, who performed no less than six roles in the play himself, and he also sang songs, including The Martyrs of Our Land and Mom Cray, or Handful of Earth. Mrs. Drew herself did not appear in the show, and indeed, by this point, she tended to only perform in just the first and the last shows of the season. Though she was glad of the business touring combination productions brought, on the whole, this was not a change she really approved of. And as she later wrote,
"During my long career as manager, I have seen the stock company system pass through its palmiest days to give place to the present horde of wandering combinations or companies of strolling players, condemned to the wearisome round of performances of the same play year in and year out, deprived of a settled home, doomed to play week after week of one-night stands, compelled to rise at all hours of the night and morning from uncomfortable beds in queer hotels, to take trains on which they must travel all day long, and reach their destination barely in time to appear supperless on the stage. When I first took up the manager's reins, there were no matinee performances. Looking back over my more than quarter of a century of management and my 63 years of professional life, I may well exclaim with Ophelia, woe is me to have seen what I have seen. See what I see.
But Louisa Lane Drew's career was hardly over. Indeed, at this point, she had two more decades to go on the stage. At last, we've reached the portion of her life that she became mostly remembered for in the wider culture. And although she was past the glory years of her management of Mrs. John Drew's Art Street Theater, at last we've reached the portion of her life that she became mostly remembered for in the wider culture. Because to most people, even more memorable than her long stewardship of the Art Street Theater was the fact that in her busy household in the 1880s, she was also the grandmother and the chief caregiver of those three famous siblings, Lionel, Ethel, and John Barrymore. Their father, the English actor Maurice Barrymore, had first made his appearance in Philadelphia in 1875. Brought home for the weekend by young John Drew, who wanted to introduce him to his peach of a sister, Georgie. Though Maurice Barrymore's real name, he freely allowed, was Herbert Blythe, he had only taken the name of Barrymore professionally when he went on the stage, at the insistence of his well-connected family, who didn't want the disgrace of being connected to the theater. Maurice was athletic, educated, physically graceful, astoundingly witty, utterly charming, and devastatingly handsome. Oh, the female servants kept peering up the back stairs just to get a peek at him. The shy Aideen Stevens nearly fainted when he walked by her in the hallway, and even old Mrs. Kinlock threw him a kittenish wink from time to time. Georgie, for her part, liked him just fine, as it turned out, and with her own quick wit, beauty, and fiery temperament, proved more than a match for him. Within a few months, they were engaged. Although the skeptical Mrs. Drew was unsuccessful in damping the fires of romantic attraction between them, she was at least able to insist that the couple be married at the family church of St. Stephen's in Philadelphia, which they were, on December 31st, 1876. The happy couple immediately launched into an active performing and touring career, and their stormy marriage sometimes took them far apart from each other, though they were together enough to produce Lionel in 1878, Ethel in 1879, and John, finally, in 1882. All of the Barrymore children were born in Philadelphia each time on the insistence of Mrs. Drew. Georgie always returned home when the day of delivery drew near. But despite their growing family, Georgie and Maurice Barrymore were soon traveling around the country again, both often in the company of the charismatic Polish actress Helena Modjeska, who seems to have accomplished the amazing trick of both seducing Maurice while at the same time convincing Georgie to join her faith and convert to the Catholic Church. Georgie became such a convinced Catholic, in fact, that all three of the Barrymore children were eventually rebaptized and raised as Catholics, much to the annoyance of their Episcopalian grandmother. Maurice, for his part, remained mostly unrestrained and unreligious and unrepentant, both on the stage and in his personal behavior. There's a story of him once returning home very late from his night's carousing, only to find Georgie at the door, dressed and ready for morning mass. "Oh, go to church, my dear," said Maurice, sweeping a gracious arm towards the street. "Go to hell, my dear," replied Georgie, with an equally gracious smile, as she put on her hat and glided off. With their parents so often at odds or away, it was Mrs. Drew who was the anchor in the early lives of her three grandchildren. Throughout her life, she'd always taken care of others, her mother, her stepsisters, her wayward husbands, her children, legitimate or otherwise, and her company, and now she was devoted to solemn little Lionel, quiet and shy little Ethel, and dreamy young John, who was her secret favorite. They were allowed to call her Mum-Mum, and were no doubt reassured by the regularity and strict discipline she brought to their early lives. The Drew family was now living at a large row home at 140 North 12th Street, even though the neighborhood north of Market Street, where the house and the theater were located, was beginning to go downhill. Daughter Georgie, with her usual wit, called the house the Tomb of the Capulets, due to the fact that a gravestone carving business was right across the street, with its sad monuments on prominent display. But even less reputable establishments like billiard halls, minstrel shows, and burlesque theaters surrawded them on every side. Bawdy houses and opium dens were not that far away. Their Uncle Sidney often slipped away to shoot pool and run after chorus girls, while shy and sickly Aideen, whom they called Aunt Tibby, stayed home and did her best to look after the children, although Aunt Tibby was to die of TB at the age of 28. Mrs. Kinloch, their great-grandmother, lived to the age of 93, though she was a rather fearsome presence in the house, and mostly stayed in her room, coming down only for dinner or on Sundays for church. But truth be told, the family needed the money now that Georgie and Maurice were earning in their whirlwind and glamorous careers. The Art Street Theater was no longer attracting the respectable crowds of theatergoers that it once had. The best theaters were all now moving to larger and more fashionable houses along Broad and Chestnut Streets in Philadelphia. Maurice and Georgie Barrymore eventually took the children away from Philadelphia in the mid-1880s and went off to try to conquer the London stage. And when that didn't work out, they settled on Staten Island in New York. When her mother died in 1887, Louisa Drew was mostly left alone in the house and realized that there was nothing for it but to go on tour herself once again.
What was I to do with myself? I couldn't live in Philadelphia in the manner in which I had always lived. Couldn't afford it. To look about for something to do at 72 years of age.
Oh, the world of American theater had changed much during her lifetime. And now every city in the country, large and small, had many theaters controlled by huge national commercial syndicates. American newspapers now all had huge sections devoted to the exciting goings-on of the theater world around the country, and every actor and every play was competing for a national, not just for local attention. What you needed as a performer was not just a variety of roles in different plays to put into one theater, but one highly recognizable and well-packaged production that you could tour everywhere. And from long experience, Mrs. Drew knew there was one role in one play that could always be reliably depended upon to pack the audiences in. Mrs. Malaprop, with her famously hilarious word substitutions, in William Brinsley Sheridan's 1775 comedy of manners, The Rivals.
Oh, Sir Anthony, you overwhelm me with profusion. However, as Shakespeare says, all's well that ends well. As for these young people who are about to enter into the maze of matrimonial duplicity, I freely give them my malediction. For myself, my motto shall be nil disparandum. And if we have been fortunate enough to secure the reprobation of our friends, we may cheerfully await the solicitations while enjoying the expression of their depreciation.
Louisa Drew had actually done the leading lady role of that play, that of Mrs. Teasle, many times during her careers. She only started performing the character role of Mrs. Malaprop starting at the age of 59. She had done it a number of times at the Art Street Theater, but only on special occasions. But now she teamed up with her old comrade in arms, Joseph Jefferson, from another longtime Philadelphia theater family, who played the part of Bob Acres, and he had edited the play down from 5 acts to 3. This was a production made to tour and designed to please the largest crowd possible wherever it went. She even begrudgingly brought along her son-in-law Maurice Barrymore as Captain Jack Absolute, whom Mrs. Malaprop described as the very pineapple of perfection. although Maurice was notorious for forgetting his lines. One night, in fact, he appalled her by wittily improvising everything he said in a key scene between them, leaving her with only her carefully rehearsed lines in reply. Oh, he knew that the version of the play they were doing was heavily cut and rewritten in order to highlight the parts for Mrs. Drew and Mr. Jefferson. In fact, he once quipped to a newspaper reporter, the whole production reminded him of a dispatch from the front during the Civil War. And Sheridan, 20 miles away. If you Google Mrs. John Drew nowadays and look for pictures of her, the first dozen or so images that pop up will all be of her as Mrs. Malaprop. Now, we all know by now that she did hundreds of other roles in her long career, but that's not the way the internet works. And if you're not careful, the easily obtainable images that you see are the ones that you let shape your mental image of her entire life story. Because this late career role, Mrs. Malaprop, was such a big hit for her, there are plenty of great photos from the 1880s and the 1890s of Mrs. Drew wearing an elaborate 18th century dress with a ridiculous hat, an enormous white wig, her prominent eyes popping out of her head. I've actually used one as the cover photo for this episode. Oh, she filled the part of Mrs. Malaprop with such a presence that it became the most delightful feature of the play, one that everybody went to see, a sort of Dogberry in petticoats. A bit of original stage business she herself came up with is now recreated in almost every subsequent production of the play. Joseph Jefferson, her co-star, never stopped being impressed by it and said it was one of the finest things he'd ever seen on the stage. Described it in details in his memoirs. Quote, "When Mrs. Malaprop handed the letter to the captain to read, by accident she gave him her own love letter lately received by her from Sir Lucius O'Trigger. As the captain reads the first line, which betrays the secret, Mrs. Drew starts, blushes, and simperingly explains that there is a slight mistake. Her manner during this situation was the perfection of comedy. During the first rehearsal in Philadelphia, she asked me if I thought the introduction was admissible. I replied that I not only thought it was admissible, but believed that Sheridan himself would have introduced it if the idea had happened to occur to him." After many miles on the road with the rivals, traveling all over America, in 1891, Mrs. Drew finally resigned from the management of the Arch Street Theater. Indeed, by that time, she derived very little income from it. Unlike her contemporary Edwin Forrest, she had never, in fact, made a great deal of money from the theater. It was how she made a living, not a killing. There was a testimonial performance given in her honor at the Academy of Music, and then she moved away to join her children in New York. Sadly, both her daughters, Louisa and Georgie, died soon after, and in 1896, Louisa herself, at last, stopped performing. Hobbled by sadness and various ailments, appalled by the realization that she couldn't seem to remember her lines properly anymore, in August of 1897, she finally passed away at her son John Jr.'s house in Larchmont, New York. Her body was brought back to Philadelphia, and her funeral was held at St. Stephen's Episcopal Church on 10th Street. Mrs. John Drew was buried next to Mr. John Drew at Glenwood Cemetery in Philadelphia, along with her mother, her sisters, and her daughters. Eventually, that whole cemetery was closed, and the grounds were appropriated for other uses in the way that many Philadelphia burial grounds have often been, historically. And John Drew Jr. had all the family graves transferred farther north to Mount Vernon Cemetery, where they still are, and where eventually Mrs. Drew would be joined by him and by many of her Barrymore descendants. But we'll talk about all those Barrymores, perhaps, another day. Really, to my mind, it's rather unfair that there's now a blue metal historical marker standing on the corner of Arch and 6th Streets, which is all that remains of the long-ago presence of the Arch Street Theater that once stood there. On the sign, it mostly natters on about the Barrymores and not her. Though Maurice, Ethel, Lionel, and John, and all the rest of the Barrymores did occasionally perform in Philadelphia, really, their professional lives were mostly spent elsewhere, in New York, London, Hollywood. And in terms of theater history, there are a lot of other reasons to talk about the Arch Street Theater. For example, it spent just as many years as a vibrant home for Yiddish drama in the early 20th century as it did for English language drama under the control of Mrs. Drew in the previous era. But that sort of a mission, after all, is why we're doing this show. And we will certainly return to the Arch once again in future episodes. But for the moment, I feel privileged to have been able to bring the story of Louise Elaine Drew to you. She was the last real figure in 19th century Philadelphia to make the local theater of this city matter for a long time. And as she made her final exit, big changes were coming in the city. We will do our best to explore them in upcoming episodes as the 20th century inexorably approaches. But before we do, we're going to backtrack a bit and cover some of the other stories about Philadelphia theater in the 19th century, ones that we've passed by along the way so far. Please keep listening for them and come along with us. There's so much more great stuff to explore and to find out about. I'm Peter Schmitz, and the sound and the music are by Christopher Mark Colucci. The voice of Louise Elaine Drew was performed by Susan Riley Stevens. And I must also again acknowledge all the help I received from Karen Sooney and the staff of the Rare Book Department of the Free Library of Philadelphia. If you'd like to have a daily dose of Philadelphia theater history, please follow us on Facebook or Twitter. The links are in the show notes. As always, there are additional images, blog posts, and bibliography about this episode and all others on our website. Most of all, I want to thank you for coming along on another adventure in theater history, Philadelphia.